Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 3rd of July, 2019. And I, as always, as I do at the beginning, unfortunately, of these things, explain to you that this work that I'm, especially the topic I'm dealing with today, is very difficult. It's hard to find good information on it. And it goes to show how, you know, you can't have part-time or amateur people doing this. You know, you'll have our areas and regions that we specialize in, and we need to focus on that, generally speaking, because the information in any one of them is so overwhelming. So as always, to the extent that, you know, the stuff I do here is very original. No one else is doing what I'm doing. I've created entire, you know, mini schools of thought that, of course, you know, never cite me. You know, if the people who take my stuff, it's okay, but just a thank you wouldn't kill you. You know, I mean, sometimes you just forget, but come on, you know who you are. But I'm talking about today. My site, as most of you know, rushjournal.org. Last week it was down for a few days for reasons I don't fully understand. It is secure from attacks. It's actually very well, secured from this. Sometimes the price of that, sometimes it will occasionally, malfunction. It was only for a couple of days. So if you guys reached the site, you tried to donate or something like that, and it wasn't up, it's no problem. But if at any time the rushjournal.org site is down, you go to the WordPress site, which Sven has created for me on Radio Aryan, which is right here in the links. So either way, you can get to me. I want to talk about a book, really a concept. A very rare book. I think there's only 25 copies, at least, you know, initial printings in existence. Blood Passover by Ariel Toaff, who was the son of the chief rabbi of Rome, who himself is a scholar at the University of Tel Aviv. And of course, it's on the so-called blood libel issue. Well, libel's in the name. If it's in the name, it must mean it's automatically false. You know, it's like the word torture, which is actually going to come up here in a minute. Torture is a negative by definition. Torture is always bad. There is no good torture. You may inflict pain for information, but that's not torture if it's for a good cause. If someone says, you know, you're rushing through, well, rushing is always bad. You know, you're moving too quickly. That's a value judgment. So calling it libel, which implies that it's false, is built right into the name, which is very typical. But one of the things that Toaff himself has said, that the fact that this can easily be published in Israel, but never outside of it, is the problem. What Jews are willing to say to one another, and me being from a Jewish area, you know, I know what they say to one another when they think no Gentiles are listening. Versus what they say in public are two different things. Jews are aware that there are sects that do this. Toaff has so much evidence here. He has so many citations from rabbinical scholars going way back, and even going back to before Christ. it's overwhelming. Some of you may have heard of the 2005 case we'll get to here in a minute. And Krasnoyarsk in Ukraine, which has yet to be solved for very obvious reasons. This is something now today that, if it were to occur, it would be a guaranteed acquittal. As in Belli's case, he was acquitted prior to World War I. What's the blood libel? And why is it continuing? Why is it always coming up? It's always the case with Jews. No other group has these issues. You've had lots of minorities in European history that have done very well. Armenians are a classic example. Turks, Syrians, various Arabs, Asians that have done very well, that have never been thrown out of country after country, that have never had these kind of allegedly, libelous attacks hurled at them. What's striking about blood libel, and I'm just going to call it simply ritual killing now. I mean, this has been my thesis last year for the murder of Tsar Nicholas. It was a ritual killing. That's not my opinion. That's what was written on the wall. That's the nature of what was done. It's been done elsewhere in a very more or less similar formula. But at this point here, once this book was published in 2009, I think it was 2004, it was banned outside of Israel, but not inside of it. Ritual killing is the notion that the Jewish elite, the Jewish rabbinate, hates a group so much, they despise a group so much that their whole identity rests on it. And to ritualize the destruction of that group, or that person, as in the case in Purim, Haman, it's essential for them to constantly be reinforced. The hatred is so overwhelming. And Haman, in the Book of Esther, every Purim, they ritualize the torture and killing of him, the Babylonian leader, viceroy, actually. And of course, remember, everyone like him. It's not just him. During the Seder meal, it's not just the Egyptians. It's all enemies of the Jews. The ritual killing is a killing that is so essential to who and what the Jews are at the level of the rabbinate. And we're talking only about Talmudists here, of course. That their system, it's not a theology because there's no God, but that their system would fall apart without it. Without Christ to hate, there would be no Talmudic Judaism. And by extension, Christians and the church, which were all considered one thing, associated also with the city of Rome. More specifically, in this particular case, we're not just talking about the ritual killing of a family like Tsar Nicholas. We're talking about a specific Passover ritual where the powdered blood of a Gentile child, almost always male, is mixed in with the matzah as a sign of complete, ultimately it's a sign of complete victory. Now, there's a lot of evidence out there that powdered blood has been used in medieval Judaism as a medicine. Now, allegedly, there's this Old Testament prohibition that they are supposed to care about the consumption of blood. But remember, we're only talking about Gentile children. That's not significant enough for it to actually be a part of that prohibition. Essentially, you're talking about an animal here. Ancient Jewish texts, according to Toff, show that powdered blood in various forms they don't specifically say it has to be Gentile, but it's good for epilepsy. It's good for healing wounds. It's good for various things internally. And there's always been the notion that Jews have always had a blood connection. You know, things like heavy menstruation and nosebleeds, all kinds of hemorrhages, more than other people, or at least are more sensitive to it than other people. At least that's the older, much older theory. And that, you know, blood, it's a principle of secular life. Now, we're not going to talk about, you know, killing Christ. This is the most ridiculous thing. Of course, the you know, Pharisees, demanded Christ's death and would threaten to riot and go to Caesar if he didn't kill him. Pilate was innocent there. The Jews at the time are responsible for. But generations afterwards are not. That doesn't mean that they're not responsible for the exact same thing. That is the destruction of the church. In this particular case, Jews have much blood on their hands. And we've been talking about this for, you know, years and years and years. It's the one forbidden topic. And at the Freedom Palooza, I had a chance to speak with Mr. Rosoli, who I'm pretty sure is from New Jersey, who I've never heard of before. But he is, you know, allegedly an apostle about this kind of thing. And he's just, you know, he's an ordinary guy who just had enough. He deals with Holocaust issues only. And he's very brash and exactly what we need, an older man. But when you compare, you know, Jewish crimes to so-called Christian crimes, and of course they're that's apples and oranges too, because Jews are far more of a unified group than Christians are. In fact, over the last, you know, 500 years, that the word is meaningless. Anyway, in the Kabbalah, which is the root of all occultism, segula is the medicinal element there, and blood is to be found as a common cure. It can't be liquid. Now that kind of gets around the no consumption of blood. Well, it's not human because it's from a Gentile boy. And number two, it's in powdered form and it's been diluted and it's been mixed in with other things, so it's not really blood. Clearly, even with meat, there's absolutely no way to completely drain a cow of blood. There's always going to be trace elements. Believe it or not, it wasn't all that uncommon in the Middle Ages for, I shouldn't say just Middle Ages, even in early modern times, for Jewish women after a bris to try to get their hands on the foreskin, because swallowing it would increase their chances of conception. That's something that Toaff makes fun of quite a bit. He quotes Shabbatai Lipschitz, Shmuel Nathan, Abraham Miranda from North Africa. But this is not uncommon. That, of course, is also the ingestion of blood. This doesn't seem to be a problem. And even at the Trent, with, of course, Simon of Trent, one of the most famous ritual killings, Israel Wolfgang explained at his testimony that it's okay, you know, this kind of blood is okay if it's done for the purposes of expressing dominance, expressing hatred, or, less importantly, some kind of medicine that you would use for a salve or something like that. Now, it's common to read in the literature that so much of this testimony was done under torture. when you actually read the primary documents, if they exist, you realize that that's not really the case. Medievals and early moderns weren't idiots. They're probably a lot smarter than we are. They realize that someone's going to say whatever you want them to say if the torture is bad enough. So we talk about torture. We're really talking about things like sleep deprivation, just relentless questioning, purpose not so much to cause pain but to break down inhibitions. I'm not just talking about someone who screams something because he wants the pain to stop. No one believes, no one in history has ever believed, except Alan Dershowitz, I guess, that that's a legitimate way to get information. I mean, I suppose in the most extreme circumstances. You know, you could think of some emotional circumstance, but outside of the most extreme things, no one would ever take a confession like that seriously, even in the American judicial system, as well as the medieval judicial system, the Byzantine judicial system. Those kind of confessions weren't actually confessions. They weren't morons. Now, one of the problems with this too is that we realize the testimony that you get. I mean, every few years. I mean, starting from, say, the time of St. Augustine to the French Revolution, roughly, so 1791. There's a lot more after that, but in that period of time, you have one every few years. They're all over the place. And of course, it can't be identical, but the testimony is very similar. It doesn't matter how the testimony is reached, it seems to be the same thing over and over again. It's sort of like, why do Jews get kicked out of every society that they succeed in? Well, it's because they go too far. Well, why do they go too far? Because when they start succeeding and they start dominating, they begin to have these messianic hopes. And since the messianic hope is on its way, there's no reason for them to hold back. So they go too far. Importantly, every time the Jews have been kicked out of an area, the accusations have been almost identical. They've been almost identical. They've had nothing to do with Christ-killing stuff. That's their propaganda. I mean, of course, you know, I'm talking about Pharisees from 2,000 years ago here. It's unfair business practices. It's compound interest. It's a lack of transparency in their business, especially, you know, banking. Prostitution, the destruction of morals. And pornography. In one form or another, of course, in the Middle Ages, it meant different things than it does now, but more or less. Well, the word pornography actually comes from prostitution anyway. So the point is, it's the same list of things. Now, Armenians, for example, have always done very well in Europe. They're very different from the rest of Europeans. They may not be European. They're on the fringes of Europe. They're considered heretics, not Christians, because they're Monophysites, even though they're part of a Christian church. And yet, they're not being thrown out of place after place after place after place. Same thing goes for the Syrians or for the Turks, for any number of small minorities in different parts of Europe throughout the ages that have done very well. Only just this one group. And part of the reason for that is once they start dominating, they get carried away. This domination, oh, now this is it. This is now the Messiah is heading our way. So we have no reason to hold back. There was a network for the buying and selling of blood, which is fairly well known. The child killing in 1504 in Germany, Philip Bader was the child's father, who actually was the man who was implicated here. There have been plenty of times where ritual accusations have been false. There have been plenty of times where Jews have been involved in killing Gentiles where there's no ritual concern. So it's not like this is an automatic situation. There has to be very specific pieces of evidence here. Remember, in the Middle Ages, the early modern era, legality was very strict. The law was to be followed by the letter, and whatever was missing was handled by very strictly understood tradition. The law was very important. You had to have specific ritual elements to it. But Philip Bader was a child's father, was implicated in as a buying and selling, I suppose, his son's blood and several others. It had to be Gentile. It had to be a child. But that's very hard back, especially back then. This is 1504, to prove. So there has to be a rabbinic seal of approval. So there was an entire bureaucracy that came into existence that would verify that, yeah, this comes from a Gentile kid with blonde hair or something like that, in such and such a place. And the Bader father, at least as far as I know, now this is, I'm taking this directly from Toaff's book, is someone who, he was a middleman in this respect. The work of Shimon Katz, for example, talks about the certificates of purity. It has to be guaranteed. Because in ritual uses, it has to be, it can't just be anything. It can't be pig's blood. Killings only occur near Passover or Purim, for obvious reasons. You know, this is something I don't need to go into. You know, Purim, we know what that is. Passover, we know this is a central feast. The Jews, and again, we're talking about Jewish Hasidics. We're talking about Jewish Hasidics who are always being protected by other Jews. So they might not be in on it. I'm sorry, they might not be doing it, but they're in on it. So there, there is a certainly a collective responsibility in the sense that I will see in the Balis case, in Kiev, Jewish witnesses against him were murdered. But Purim and Passover still have extremely violent background. And the child crucifixions, Gloucester and Norwich in the 12th century, 1155, a girl was crucified in Spain. And this is something that even there, there was the Jews had admitted that this person was some kind of crazy madman, though people aren't certain. The theory, Abbott in England, Thomas Campion, 1272, made the theory, I already alluded to this, that Jewish blood is somehow tainted because they have shed Christ and, of course, that of the church, not just Jesus personally, and that they're involved with this. So they are always concerned with getting pure non-Jewish blood to purify them. Now, I don't happen to accept that point of view, but this was an idea that many Talmudists and Kabbalists at the time accepted. But the notion of the consumption of blood is common. Remember, Jews can always get around the law. Democritus in the 2nd century BC, that the severed heads of the temple were eaten in part by foreign kings. Apior in the 1st century AD, Greek merchants were killed and exsanguinated, at least one a year. The hatred of all things Greek and Roman is absolutely essential. And we can't get into the Hellenized Jews in places like Antioch and Alexandria. But all things Greek and Roman, because these are the core of Christian thought, these are the core of the Christian identity and the very beginning of the church itself, in the major cities which it flourished. Rome is the archetype of the land power, of the common good, where Jews, in their theology prior to the advent of the Antichrist, really can't have anything to do with any settled life. And this is why so many Hasidics have been vehemently opposed to Zionism. I've mentioned this on this show before. the riots to take place, the draft riots to take place in Jerusalem, these Hasidic rabbis, although it's true they're on Israeli welfare rolls, because they don't work, their families were there long before Israel was. And they got along with Arabs and Greeks, at least in the 20th century, far better prior to 1948 than afterwards. And we talked about the power play of the Soviet Union and how the Soviets were the prime mover. And in that respect, remember, the concern isn't so much that, Jews controlled the banking and so much of the politics of the entire Western world at the defeat of Hitler. It wasn't so much being against their interests, but rather worried about what the Arabs would do. But whipping up the crowd is something that happened in all of these, after all of these ritual killings. This is what frightens the Jews, whether these are legitimate or not. I mean, they happen. There's absolutely no question that they happen. The Belus case, he was a guilty man. We'll talk about this in a minute. But it comes down ultimately to hatred. It shows how obsessed that they are with race, because race is to be found in the blood, in the genetics. We refer to your Irish blood, Finnish blood, whatever it is. And that's almost the life force of the Gentile. And in capturing the children, taking war booty, and everything that that implies is, and crucifying them and torturing them. All of these cases of ritual killing, the child has been tortured to death. We know this also in the murder of the Russian royal family. They could have just been shot in the head. That did not happen. But this concern with drinking blood and eating flesh, actual real flesh, not in the Eucharistic sense, goes back quite a bit. There's not tons of literature on it, because most people don't want to do this. There's always been the extreme anti-Hellenic mentality that was known for that. Josephus even agrees with it. Dio Cassius says that the Jews feasted on the bodies of Greek troops after battle. But peddling in flesh is normal. Since the rejection of Logos, all the trials of ritual killings that have occurred in places like Lyon, in Orléans, in Verdun, Rome, any of these other places, they abducted children, and that they did it in entirely Jewish areas, and that wherever these groups were, they were the head of the slave trade. These were always very, very, very poor, what we would call, homeless kids. Not always, but people who wouldn't be missed. It didn't make any difference who they were. And Agobard of Lyon says this in 840, that Jews were the slave trade. There was no one else involved in slavery, especially in the Mediterranean. And the Khazars had that sewn up. But it's important to remember at Purim, because this it's an essential understanding here. You read about it, and we'll talk about Haman, the Babylonian viceroy who wanted to harm the Jews, and they're victorious over him. Through Mordecai. But it's never just Haman at the Seder. It's never just Egypt. It's the bondage of all Christians, of all non-Jews. During Purim festivals, Jews would take a Gentile kid, and it wasn't necessarily even at first harmful, but they would, kind of dress him up as Haman, and sometimes they'd kill him. They didn't really mean to. They were so drunk. They'd grab some kid and they put, this occurred actually in, I believe, in Antioch, because Theodosius and Honorius, both emperors, banned the Purim marches and burning Haman in effigy, because sometimes it would be a real person there. Because they got so drunk, they didn't know or really care what they were doing. It was Socrates Scholasticus in the 5th century, Antioch 415, a Gentile kid was murdered as they were pretending he was Haman in one of these festivals. And they got carried away and they killed him. So the curses, Judaism is based on cursing. It's based on cursing their enemies, which is pretty much everyone but them, and sometimes them. But often when they're referring to Amalek, they're referring to Pharaoh, or they're referring to Haman or whatever it is, or Hitler, they're referring to you and me too. And yes, if you're an opponent of mine, if you're a liberal listening to this, you know, they mean you too, if you're not a Jew. They don't trust you either. You have the, and you see that the Haggadah reading really for, in especially in the German territories, one of the most important things in the Seder reading, in the Haggadah reading, is that Antichrist, or what they would call Messiah, can't appear unless the Gentiles are destroyed, unless their economies are crushed, unless the Jews dominate economically to such an extent, not politically, but economically, to such an extent that Gentiles are ruined, then the Messiah will come. So I mentioned the notion of going too far. I did an entire show a year and a half ago on New Khazaria in Ukraine. That's one of these places where Jews rule so absolutely. Certain parts, certain parts of the country outside of the Eastern, you're not talking about Donetsk or anything like that, that they see themselves as harbingers of Adam Kadmon. The recreation of primordial man, the ultimate revolution. The new Khazaria can be rebuilt. It's always been my opinion that Israel, as this little country in the Middle East, is not all that significant anymore. That Israel really is New York City. Israel is the big cities of the Occident in general. Israel might be a place that they could run and be protected by walls and nuclear weapons if they get in trouble. But very few Jews care what the Old Testament says about anything. They reject it. They condemn the prophets. The Talmud condemns the prophets. So that's just symbolism. Michael Hoffman has done a great job in explaining that this is pure pomp and circumstance as far as the Jewish ritual is concerned. They reject the Old Testament. That they are aware subjectively that they have no connection to anyone who lived or used to live in that part of the world. And even if they did, they have no theological connection to those people since they've been so radically altered over the years. One of the things that blood can be used for, according to Toaf, is various so-called blessings or curses before the Seder, the head of the family, takes, wine from the glass and splashes it north, south, east, west, sometimes more than that. And of course, in one case, 10 times for the 10 curses to be brought upon Egypt, but they also mean everybody. Because the Messiah, or the Antichrist, or they would call Messiah, cannot arrive if the Gentiles have any strength left at all. They have to be humiliated beyond belief. Then Antichrist can arrive. So when they curse the Gentiles, when they use blood in these rituals, when they mix blood in the mouth, whatever it might be, this is a wish fulfillment. In the Psalms, it says, you know, I grind my enemies in my teeth, which is a common metaphor at the time to show utter dominance. You know, we even use the phrase, "I have guys like you for breakfast." You know, that somehow eating is just utter consumption, domination, and victory. I can render you nothing. And this is the level of hatred that you're dealing with here. Now, the case in Krasnoyarsk in 2005, it's not all that dissimilar to the Belize case in Kiev. Was very close to Passover. There were 5 children who were abducted and murdered. Alexei, Dmitry, Maxim, Zafar, and Abdullah. They were between 10 and 12 years old. They were found a few days after their abduction at the bottom of a well, in a foundry, very badly burnt. Not completely, but very badly burnt. To this day, there are no suspects. The court is, remember, this is Ukraine now. The court is utterly paralyzed. Nukazadia, you can't go in after the, there has to be an oligarchical connection here. You can't abduct, murder, burn, and dump bodies. Not even trying to hide the bodies, which is, by the way, one of these things that all of these ritual killings have in common. And have not a single suspect. The court banned all discussion of the topic. No newspaper can be talking about it, which, by the way, under certain circumstances, we see that, like in the Cosby case or the Sandusky case, is probably a good idea. You can't have journalists who are irresponsible, often very ignorant people, speculating on something they know nothing about for the sake of telling a good story and destroying someone's reputation in the press, whether legitimately or not. But that's not what this is for. This is a general gag order that this is not something that you can, not something that you can discuss. And it occurred because 3 of the local papers, remember, there's a lot more, civic life in the East than there is in the West, contrary to mythology. The Krasnoyarsk Pravda, Top Secret, several others, 3 that I know of, came out and said this was a ritual killing. Or at the very least, there's a lot of evidence that says that this is a ritual killing. We can't ignore them. A few things that are interesting about these bodies when they were found. Of course, they were burnt very badly, but there was still quite a bit left to do analysis, and there's no blood. There was no hemoglobin or anything else like that in the muscle tissue that they found. They had been drained. There were puncture marks on the hands, you know, imitating crucifixion. It was done in a Jewish area just before Passover. One of the witnesses, Nikolai Kruglev, who I think is a vagrant, but was there at the time and was coherent at the time, in April of 05, said that he saw a black Mercedes with tinted windows take these kids. There was, as I mentioned before, a Jewish, what they call a rodef or a pursuer, a Jew that turns on other Jews for the sake of justice. This is vehemently condemned in Jewish thinking. Simon Krilstein was murdered that November. He was actually a very important witness for the prosecution. In fact, it's one of the reasons that there's really been no trial, even though this is many years ago. By the way, this is the same Hasidic group as in the Belize case. You know, this is the same, you could trace the same lineage. It's the same group of people. And not that far away from it, initially. The police badly mishandled the crime scene. And this is not the first time police have done this in a situation like this. It always reminds me of in Muncie, New York, when the Torah cart and my friends, the rabbis and the anti-Zionist, anti-Holocaust, Hasidic group, much larger than people realize, Rabbi Weiss and Rabbi Feldman, they've been getting threats for years. This is, you know, a decade ago at least. That the JDO, maybe the JDL too, but the JDO was going to burn down their synagogue and kill them and do all kinds of nasty things to them. And, of course, it happened. As soon as they got back from the Holocaust conference in Iran, it went down to the ground. In fact, Rabbi Weiss had said, this is probably going to happen. We're going to keep an eye out on this. We're going to do what we can to keep it from happening. He wasn't there at the time. And it burned to the ground. They had received many, many threats, credible threats. It was predicted. And without much of an investigation, fire chief said, no foul play. And again, this shouldn't surprise anybody. It's all about who you want to piss off. You know, pissing a group of obscure rabbis off on the one hand is not a problem. But the JDL and the Jewish establishment in general, that's something else altogether. You'd rather piss off the former than the latter. The distinctions between the ADL and the JDL are mythical. It's an act. It's just the two pillars, Joachim and Boaz. It's not very real. I might want to note that the governor at the time, I don't know if he still is, Krasnoyarsk, is Alex Klopinin, who was Jewish and is close to the Hasidic sect. And this also is one of the reasons that no charges have been filed, although clearly it's a homicide. There's a few newspapers, I think Western newspapers are saying that it was an accident. You know, just like in the Belize case, they killed themselves and they tried to blame the mother. Any non-Jewish person that could rather than themselves. That this case has been kept alive by Mikhail Nazarov, a man who I've been reading for a very long time on the Union of the Russian People. Rus Idea is the, .org is the website. I've been reading them for many years, if you could read Russian. I would say that across New York, I can't remember which one it is. I think it's Pravda, comes right out and says that this is a ritual killing, and it has all the marks of it. And they're quoting Nazarov all over the place. So as it stands now, you have witnesses. You have a few dead witnesses. Clearly have a homicide. You have kids who, without doubt, died a violent death. You have bodies that the muscle tissue shows completely drained of blood. Oh, and by the way, for reasons you could probably figure out, they sent the bodies for analysis to Great Britain. Now, this is a mystery. I can't quite figure out what the mentality is here. Everything the British have in that department, they have in Kiev. They have in Krasnoyarsk. That's not a problem. Why they sent it to England, I don't know. But this is just a delay. The children have been buried. So the bodies are gone for now. But all the analysis that can be done has been done. You have, it's in a Jewish area. And you see this quite often where initially it's just a murder of kids with one person saying maybe it was a Jew. It's the Jews that mention ritual murder. This happens quite a bit, where no one's even mentioning ritual murder, and then the Jewish newspaper starts screaming, "Oh, blood libel!" No, it's just this is a Jewish guy who killed somebody, or possibly killed somebody. But we know the best known of these is the Bilis case. Just before World War I. And keep in mind, too, that there were several of these cases that didn't become very well known. The Vladimir case in 1897, the Vilna case, 1901-1902, the Dubisari case in 1903, the Smolensk case in 1910, the Kana Spectre case in 1911. These are all very similar situations to the Balice case. Just like the 2005 event, you have a very similar constellation of forces. And there's many more than that. There, of course, the victim is Andrusa Yuchinsky. And there, you know, the trial was a farce. The Jew was acquitted. But the trial itself shows you what the situation was in very heavily Jewish areas. The big thing about the Belis case is the testimony of the children. You know, the kids all said they were playing, because there was Zini and Vali, Ludmila, Tribyakov, who were playing with him at the time, and they were playing with two other young Jews. One of the Schneersons, by the way. He was murdered on March 12th, 1911. But they say this is what they were doing, that they were playing and that they were taken away. That's the first thing you have to remember about this particular case. You have the kids all saying the same kind of thing. The unusual nature of the injury. Injections in the temple area. The wounds are inflicted really on the skin, not through a shirt. The purpose being to hit them in all the right pressure points to deactivate the body entirely. Then you have, in his case, is 47 wounds. So as to facilitate the draining of blood. This was actually very, this is not obviously a murder. You need a lot more. You don't need that many, entry points to kill someone, especially a kid. As is typical of Jewish ritual murders, the body was not hidden. Kind of like in Jack the Ripper, it's put out in plain sight, so the message is being sent. There's a letter from Bilis to his wife that was transmitted through his cellmate, Kachachenko, that promises a substantial reward for the poisoning of important witnesses against him. That confirmed the testimony of his abduction of Andrusha. There were blood-soaked clay on children that's very similar to the Jewish-owned brick factory where the crime was committed. Remember, this is where the kids were found. In both cases here, it's not where the murder occurred. But it's very clear that the clay that would be found at the Jewish-owned brick factory is what was on the children when they were found. You'll see in a lot of these cases, there's a substantial meeting. Jews from all over the world show up for some sort of a conference, religious or otherwise. And it always seems to be associated with this kind of development, large international gathering. The make-believe stories. Now, journalists were the worst here. I mean, journalists are bad on a good day. But using make-believe witnesses, inventing things, they accused, in both 2005 and in here, they accused gypsies, they accused the parents, they accused neighbors, They accused criminal gangs locally. And, you know, within a very brief period of time in court, these were dismissed as laughable. In the Belize case, the Jews were so powerful globally. And Russia was a tough nut for them to crack, but in the western part of the empire, they had tremendous power. They had their committee to defend Belize. It raised, you know, millions of rubles. And it actually became a group of some political force. And they were back and forth with the American Jewish Committee head, Marshall and Rabbi Ginsburg. And they're making reference to, in their correspondence, they're making reference to the Talmud and Zohar and everything else. You know, these are the people who talk about the ritual elements of this. There was an attempt by the chief lawyer of the Belize Defense Committee, A.D. Margolin, who offered to pay Vera Tribakov, which was, you know, his mother, 40,000 rubles, gold rubles at the time, which was a big deal, and safe passage out of the country if she would confess. Jewish thugs, Mikhalin and Karyev, who did actually go to local gangs, just, you know, street nobodies, and forced them to say that you know, we were involved. They weren't, of course, and that was thrown out right away. It was very clear what was going on. But the fact that this defense committee is involved in strong-arming all of these people and bribing and all this stuff, and even the fact that they were the ones who made this a ritual matter. So many of them, so many witnesses didn't show. The factory itself, the foundry itself, the crime scene was completely destroyed. There was a murder committed there, and it was whitewashed. Parts of it were rebuilt. It wasn't a crime scene anymore. You know, it would be completely destroyed. All the main witnesses, including the two children who were playing with him the time of his abduction, Zhinya and Ludmila Vali, they barely survived. But Krasovsky, who was part of the court administration, would show up to their homes, you know, you kids okay, and bring these cakes. These cakes were poisoned. Slowly but surely they were being poisoned to shut up. And only Zhinya was actually killed. Ludmila barely made it, but with permanent injuries. So the court administration was involved in this. The court administration itself was involved in the defense committee. Zichenko, Bolhovsky were two important witnesses for the prosecution that disappeared. The press, Jewish, and those dominated by Jews, were deliberately make-believe. It was a bizarre case, and the Belize and the ritual murder case, something like the Dreyfus is probably the same thing. You have people who had no idea, intellectuals from Great Britain and Norway and America writing these long, letters to the prosecution saying, how dare you do this to these people? They didn't know what was going on. There was a gag order on this stuff outside of the courtroom, but because it was the Jews, they said you can't do it. Prosecution expert witnesses were harassed. They were constantly being threatened. In the trial itself, the journalists were a part of the defense committee and were really had to be removed from the courtroom more than once for making noise, causing trouble, you know, staring down witnesses, all these things. There was a bronze medal of Belis that was struck in Britain to protest all of this. They made a bronze medal out of the man, making him some sort of a saint. In fact, the U.S.-Russian trade agreement was terminated under pressure from the American Jewish Committee. Which was, you know, only affected a few things. That's how powerful this was. Deliberate, you know, when something is deliberately made up, deliberate storytelling, you know that there's a problem. So between 1918-1919, after the war, all witnesses in this case were killed, including the main prosecution expert witness, who was sent to a camp. But of all these outrages done against the court, and again, this is in the Russian Empire, in the western part, in the far, you know, the Ukrainian part, but one of the most ominous and one of the nastiest comes from the committee itself, the Defense of Belus Committee. And they issued a statement. Let me read it here. I'm reading directly from the Russian right now. "Please let them believe this sort of thing about us as much as they like. What business should we be ashamed of? For the people here, the Jewish people, or a royal people, we are not liable and not obligated to justify anything. We are not obligated to report to anyone. We don't hold an examination before anybody. No one could ever hold us to account. Before them, we came and we leave afterwards. We're before, we're after. We are as we are. We're good for ourselves. We will not be absorbed into their system, so to speak. And we don't want to be absorbed into their system." This is what the, you know, this is the legal team saying this kind of thing. This isn't just, you know, anybody. The defense brought in these so-called religious and philosophical experts. And there seemed to be no real, in the Belus case, there seems to be no vetting procedure here. Like Troitsky and Glagolev, Kovaltsov, the other people, Rabbi Mays, When the prosecution brought up things like the Zohar, the mentioning of blood as medicine and Talmudic references, they had no idea, or at least pretended that they had no idea. So many of the so-called Christians had never heard of this stuff before. They claimed to have never heard of the Saratov, the other ritual killings that I had mentioned years ago, or even that there was such a thing as an anti-Talmudic movement. So many of the so-called experts had very little knowledge of the area that they were talking about. They denied it a priori. It can't be done because Jews are incapable of this. You know, quite a bit is made of in the New Testament, where the Israelites under the command of the Pharisees said, "May his blood be upon us and our children." Well, this is said here as well. This is a common statement. Let me read the statement of the rabbis of Russia, which was written in the middle of this case. They say, again, I'm reading this directly from the Russian, "With indignation, we reject the accusation of any kind of sect within our group that uses Christian blood for ritual purposes. Jewish law in its fullness, unchanged, indivisible, has no variations. There are no sects in Jewry. Jewish religion does not give and could not give ground for bloody fanaticism. Hasidim do not constitute a sect. Hasidim, like anyone else, they have the same laws, the same instructions, and rituals are obligatory for them to the smallest detail." And then one of the Jewish publicists, also working for the defense, said, "We therefore have before us an alternative. Either all Jews, from the least to the greatest, all Jews as such, are guilty of the use of Christian blood, or none." And that phrase comes up more than once in these very pompous claims from, whether it be the rabbis of Russia and other statements, where they make it very clear that this is a matter of Judaism as a group, not of any specific individuals or sects. But when you claim that there are no sects in Judaism, then by definition, Belus must be innocent. Remember, they're the ones who made this a ritual case. It didn't start off that way. They were the ones who, you know, a Jewish man possibly kills a Gentile. And the first thing that the Jews say, well, there's no ritual killing here. Well, you weren't accused of that. You know, you were the guys who brought it up. You made it into a ritual killing. In fact, the defense was focusing on the idea that, well, this isn't really a ritual killing, therefore he's innocent. What is a ritual killing in Russian law? Which, of course, it did not exist. And therefore, I wonder if this could even be prosecuted. That's how dishonest the defense was. So let me summarize here very briefly about ritual killings in general, the Bayless case, the 2005 case, and all the other dozens or hundreds of them that have come up over the years. Here's what they seem to have in common. They seem to occur at a time where there's a large Jewish religious gathering internationally. Not just a feast, but something is going on. And a large number of people are coming in. Number two, the victims are usually quite poor, that they're nobodies, and they figure, well, no one will miss them. Number three, that the victim is tortured, because these very small cuts to maximize, you know, the efficiency of the bleeding, it's got to be agonizing. And of course, they also paralyze the kid, which brings us to the next point. Number five, that these are done professionally. Whoever did this knows what he's doing. The use of the scalpel in most of these cases is very similar to what you would do in a kosher slaughterhouse. A lot of the techniques are the same. So this is highly professional work. Number six, the blood is very efficiently collected. There's not a whole lot of blood at any of the scenes involved. Number seven, no one ever tries to hide the bodies. They're put on public display. So it's an act of terrorism, at least in that sense, because you're trying to frighten the population. And of course, there's a network of a blood trade that exists and always comes up in court. There's an ideology. This is always in a Jewish area close to a major feast. This is what they all seem to have. Oh, and lastly, there is sexual abuse quite often. 1429, 1597, and 1791. There's definitely signs of sexual abuse. That's not the case in all of them. So, which of course part of the torture element here. So these children don't just die needlessly for some stupid psycho superstition, but they die an agonizing death. Therefore, I think you also, a lot of us need to take a moment to remember these young boys throughout the centuries, many of whom have been canonized, but certainly not all of them, who have suffered needlessly. The intense feeling, some of the miracles that have occurred at these sites, it's not the case in 05 as far as I know, but not the case even in the Belus case either. Other ones, I think the Saratov case, you had it. There's tremendous power. The innocence of that's been outraged here shows itself in that kind of power. And some of these boys are canonized. It's very rarely girls. This is the nature of the of the enemy. This is who we're dealing with. There's no question that ritual murder exists. There's no question the evidence is overwhelming. There's no question that Jewish scholars fully admit it. But they only admit it when none of us are listening, as Toaff's book makes clear. If you read Toaff's book, if you get your hands on it, a PDF version of it, it is absolutely shocking. This is a part of Jewish theology. It's not something done every day, but it's something done on a regular basis, and that the hatred of Gentiles is so overwhelming that they can't control themselves. They need blood. They need to show it and put the body on display. This is something I think that Gentiles, that Orthodox people can't quite wrap their head around. It shows you how far we are in one another. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.